Second Sunday Shakespeare is brought to you by Pier 1 Theater, Kachemak Bay Campus, and Friends of the Homer Library. Pier 1 Theater is made possible by grants from the City of Homer, the Alaska State Council on the Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts, the Rasmussen Foundation, the Homer Foundation, and by contributions from community members like you.
Hello there, everyone. Welcome to Shakespeare in Context. This is our second month in podcast form, and we're happy that you're here listening to us. This is a supplemental program of the monthly Second Sunday Shakespeare event, where we examine historical and cultural context surrounding the play we're about to read. This program is co-sponsored by the newly formed Mud Bay Bards, a branch of Pier 1 Theater, Friends of the Homer Library, and the Kachemak Bay Campus. Today, we have Mike Hoffield here again, Professor Emeritus from Kachemak Bay College, here to chat with us about the historically related events to The Merchant of Venice, which is our monthly read this month. And I'm Sarah Brewer, Chair of the Mud Bay Bards. And I also wanted to give a quick thank you to Leslie Freed from the Alaska Jewish Museum in Anchorage, who provided some wonderful resources. So we always start off with a quick summary of the play. The Merchant of Venice takes place in 16th century Venice, where a merchant named Antonio is worried that he's overextended his wealth. He asks his friend Bassanio for help, but when he cannot afford the loan, Bassanio goes to borrow some money on the security of Antonio's expected gains when his ships come in. Bassanio approaches a Jewish moneylender, Shylock, about a loan. Antonio resents Shylock for charging interest on loans and has engaged in incredibly anti-Semitic behavior towards him. Shylock offers an interest-free loan, but he asks for a pound of flesh from Antonio if the loan isn't repaid in 3 months, to which Antonio agrees. Shylock's daughter Jessica wants to marry Lorenzo, who is a friend of Antonio and also a Christian. She eventually runs away with him, taking gold and jewels with her. Shylock is enraged by this. There's a third plot where a young woman named Portia has a recently deceased father whose will stipulates that she can only marry a man who chooses correctly between these three caskets, one of gold, one of silver, and one of lead. All of her suitors until this point have been unsuccessful. Bassanio ends up choosing the correct casket and wins Portia. But right about this time, we learn Antonio's ships have been lost at sea and he's now bankrupt, and Shylock is insisting on this pound of flesh. Portia then follows the men to Venice with her friend Nerissa and tries to help disguised as a lawyer. It takes us to the court in Venice. Portia gives a famous speech disguised as this lawyer named Balthazar. She pleads with Shylock. He refuses. When this happens, she brings out the contract that stipulates that while he's entitled to that pound of flesh, he has not agreed to a single drop of blood. He's then found guilty of threatening the life of a Venetian. Half of his goods are forfeited to Antonio. And Shylock is also forced to become a Christian. The play ends with Shylock completely disgraced, and there's these three couples that get to celebrate their upcoming marriages. This question that's surrounding this debate that scholars and critics have pondered is whether or not Shakespeare was perpetuating anti-Semitic views, or if he was trying to hold up that mirror to the prejudices of the time, and also trying to humanize the stereotypes that were around then with some of these beautifully written speeches. So Mike, I'll turn it over to you. What can you tell us about what had happened even historically before Shakespeare's time surrounding people of the Jewish faith in England?
Medieval England in particular was intensely Christian. England in particular in the later 1200s, and certainly through the 1300s and 1400s leading up to Shakespeare's time, was becoming more intensely what we would refer to as nationalistic. They're seeing themselves as English as different from those French, as different from especially those Irish or the Scots and so on. So people beginning to identify themselves as Christians, they also saw themselves as the right faith, the God-given, God-correct belief structure. And their culture is deeply enmeshed in Christian thinking of the crusading era. Crusades to take back the Holy Land for Christians, to throw Muslims out and Jews, they become perceived as an enemy based on a deep sense of popular piety, which means it's very largely non-thinking piety. There develops a kind of xenophobia in England, and not, England isn't the only place. Spain and France and parts of Italy are all experiencing the same sort of thing, become suspicious of what historians refer to as the other, the outsiders. And it could be Irish, it could be Scots if you're English. It also especially focuses on Jews. England became so xenophobic about their Jewish population, which was quite small in the 1200s, the King of England, Edward I, expelled the Jews from England completely. It was the first of the European countries actually to expel the Jews from their country. That was in 1290.
When that happened, Mike, did people of the Jewish faith have the opportunity to stay if they would convert? Or was it if you were of any Jewish descent, you were out?
The king initiated a staged expulsion of Jews from England. And the first phases would offer or tend to move towards forcing people to convert to Christianity from Judaism. Of course, there were Jews who refused to do that, and some left on their own. But there was an emerging caste of Jews who converted to Christianity. They were called conversos in Spain, for instance. There also emerges another group of people in England who were Jewish and are now professing to be Christian. Mm-hmm. And there grows a suspicion that maybe they're not really Christian. Sometimes it's connected to the money lending thing, is because Christians were not allowed to take interest on lending money. Jews were allowed to do that. So they sort of became the bankers of Europe in the 1100s, 1200s. And kings like Edward I depended heavily on raising money through them. So did crusaders of all kinds, but also because they had to pay back those loans, conjured all sorts of ill will, which is what we see reflected in Antonio in Merchant of Venice. He plays on this idea that, oh God, I got to pay it back with interest. Are you kidding? How unchristian could you be? As that kind of chatter goes on behind all of this. This is the beginning of an eastward migration out of Western Christian countries towards the eastern end of the Mediterranean and in Eastern Europe, where they could survive and could continue as Jews. This would culminate, of course, in the same year that Christopher Columbus hits upon the what he calls the New World, is the expulsion of Jews from Spain as well. That was the final expulsion in Europe. It's conceivable, given this expulsion had taken place over a long period of time, and, you know, thinking of it from in England, 1290, they were expelled. And it was the length of time that the United States has existed between that point and Shakespeare's time. That's a long period of time when it was not legal to be Jewish in England. Some have raised the question, did Shakespeare even know a Jew?
The sources of the play involved a collection of Italian stories from the late 14th century from Ser Giovanni Fiorentino, but Chris Marlowe also wrote something around that time, The Jew of Malta, for all of the playwrights at the time. Again, if there were no people of Jewish faith in the area, they're really basing this on legends and lore. There was also something that happened in the time, the Lopez affair.
Rodrigo Lopez, sometimes referred to in the time of his trial as Lopez the Jew, he's actually a converso. And I'm not sure how far back in his own family history, the Lopez family living in England became Christian. And they were practicing, church-going Christians. They did everything the neighbors did. Lopez became the physician to Queen Elizabeth, which is a very, very intimate relationship with the monarch, a very key person in the court of Elizabeth I. And there grew a jealousy and opposition to Lopez in the court, led by the Earl of Essex, who was a very powerful lord, sometimes suitor to Queen Elizabeth, and sometimes she has to rein him in on a variety of things. He's a real explosive figure in this time period of the 1590s. Indeed, he has a falling out with Lopez and is determined to bring Lopez down, which means to discredit him within the court. And ultimately, there arises even an opposition to Queen Elizabeth, the monarch, charges that Lopez is a secret Jew, that he's going to poison the queen. He's secretly receiving money from the King of Spain. So keeping in mind, the Spanish threat is still alive and well in the minds of most English. They're the bad guys on the horizon. The Armada was defeated in 1588, but it kept coming back. The threat of it certainly was there all the time. Queen Elizabeth was the Protestant monarch. The monarch of Spain was the Catholic monarch, and he was going to kind of a crusading mentality, going to bring down this wrong-thinking Christian. And so the English always had this kind of fear of this going on. So here comes Lopez. The story emerges, thanks to Essex and others, that Lopez is receiving bribes from the Spanish monarch to poison Queen Elizabeth, since he's close to her. That's all part of the xenophobia of this era, and Jews get caught right dead smack in the middle of that, and full of lies and accusations.
We have this lore, we have the sources, Marlowe's and Giovanni Fiorentino, but we also have this parallel happening with the Reformation. Catholics versus Protestants, who could be secretly practicing Catholicism.
Right.
And I wonder how much that could have influenced Shakespeare writing this, using these tales to also hold up the current mirror that was happening in England with the Reformation and the anxiety at the time surrounding that.
I think the Shakespearean era is a time of a fear of secret Catholics among all of us Protestants. England has been trying to set itself solidly in the Protestant camp in the Reformation, with the monarch as the head of the Church of England, and decidedly Protestant, trying to move away from any kind of Catholic movement to take back England for the Church of Rome. So there's that anxiety, the anxiety of Spain itself, possibly launching another invasion, effort to invade England, and then add to it all this crazy thinking about who Jews are. In English society, where they haven't had any Jews openly practicing as Jews or openly admitting that they're Jews for almost 250 years. But you have a lot of stories about who they are. Il Pecorone, the Giovanni play that Shakespeare uses as his source for Merchant of Venice, the Jew of Malta, the play, which was very popular by Christopher Marlowe, has as its central evil character a Jew. The Jew of Malta is not like the Merchant of Venice. The Merchant of Venice is Antonio. It's not even Shylock. He's the character who's the agent for certain things happening, but it's a central figure in Marlowe's play, and it's hateful. There's no way to look at that any differently. Marlowe was vicious in the way he portrays Jews. It's a part of the audience vision as well. And Shakespeare is playing to this audience. We've talked about so many times, the audience in Shakespeare's world liked the Jew of Malta. They liked the way he was ridiculed, the way he could be on stage and all the rest of it.
This does not make it right, but I wonder how much of that, to take this very historical figure, gave maybe the audience a sense of relief of the anxiety that they were feeling towards each other within the Reformation. That's something we see even now in our times. When somebody gets the chance to point the finger somewhere else, it gives you that sense of relief. It's just an interesting thing to continue to reckon with. It's kind of been debated for centuries as to the purpose of this play. Depending on who you ask, it can be seen as one of Shakespeare's most beautiful plays with these monologues, or some of his most repulsive based on the stereotypes that he was using. Was he simply perpetuating these stereotypes, or is the play making clear anti-Semitic ideas and just showing those, or is he trying to explore the theme of anti-Semitism to open the minds of his audience a little bit by making Shylock more sympathetic at times, especially with the Hath Not a Jew Eyes speech, where the Shakespeare apologists kind of use that as the holy grail of this humanism towards Shylock, as well as how he uses Portia in it. I want to let everybody hear Portia's speech. Eleanor Sweeney, she's a senior at Homer High School, and she's a drama debate forensics competitor, has agreed to perform this monologue for us. This is Portia dressed up as Balthazar, as the lawyer, giving her speech to Shylock.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself. An earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, Jew, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy. I have spoke thus much to mitigate the justice of thy plea, which, if thou follow, the strict court of Venice must needs give sentence against the merchant there.
And earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, Jew, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. This monologue is considered some of Shakespeare's best writing. When I hear this monologue, it's beautiful and it's something to embed into our bones. However, within the context of the play, it also certainly highlights this hypocrisy that's happening in the play on the part of the Christians. Portia, as Balthazar, is calling for mercy, but there has never been any mercy shown for Shylock his entire life.
Yeah.
So while it's beautiful and thought-provoking when it stands alone within this context of this play, it's a problem. I don't know if you have an opinion on what theater goers in London in Shakespeare's time might have felt hearing this.
I'm kind of two minds, as you can always be, especially with Shakespeare. What is the audience thinking? We can only guess at what Shakespeare is thinking because of what he wrote. The mercy speech is one that we all embrace, and I think audiences then embraced it too. He said, well, of course, mercy is what we learn about in church as well. We learn about the central message of Jesus and so on. I'm reminded too, earlier on in the play, how Antonio spits all over, literally spits on Shylock simply because he's a Jew. And so he has absolutely no mercy. Now, is Shakespeare trying to help us understand the plight of Jews who don't even live in London or the neighborhood? Is that what's going on? I like to read it that way, that yes, I'm enlightened by the mercy speech. I'm enlightened also by this amazing speech where Shylock says, I am a Jew, hath not a Jew eyes, hath not Jew hands, and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm a man. And I remember in the civil rights movement, one of the more moving images coming out of it are protesters, Black protesters with signs saying, I am a man.
Yeah.
And demanding that I be treated, well, like everybody, like I'm a human being. But I have this dark side of me that wonders about 1590s London and the audience, as if this isn't a moment when Shylock does the speech about I am a Jew, I am a man speech, that people in the audience don't necessarily see it, hear it the same way we do. And they may begin to see the beginnings of what will eventually become, I think, maybe, sad to say, a comedic scene, is when Shylock has to convert to Christianity.
Right.
That's the outcome of his lawsuit brought against him, or he bringing against them, is that he's not only going to lose his property, and he's going to be in anguish over that. And he's lost his daughter. He's in anguish over her becoming a Christian. Now he has to lose his Judaism. And I can't help to think that an audience sitting in the Globe, we're finding that amusing.
Or as his soul has been saved.
Yeah, but there's also, well, that's good comeuppance.
I do have the Shylock speech as well. Here is Ken Lanfield playing Shylock, and he is a wonderful Pier 1 theater veteran.
If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies. And what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer, as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why, revenge. The villainy you teach me, I will execute. And it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction.
That's the speech that's held up as this holy grail of humanism in Shylock. That's the reason why we argue whether or not Shakespeare was simply being anti-Semitic, or if he was trying to give a glimpse into the humanism that resides within every individual, including the ones that we know as others.
I prefer to believe that. And I'd like to think that that is exactly what had touched Shakespeare, because this is a very powerful character, though he is playing to a particular audience. And Stephen Greenblatt and his book, Will of the World, give some attention to the Lopez trial and ultimate his trial, his conviction, and then his execution. This was a typical traitor's execution in Elizabethan England. He was hanged, and then he was cut down before he was dead, and he was disemboweled. His limbs were removed. His genitals were hacked off, and the limbs were sent around town to be posted on pikes. I mean, this is the guy who was taking care of the queen. And the crowd howling for his death, howling to get and slaughter Lopez the Jew, is just as ringing an aspect of this world.
Right.
It's not out of character at all. And Shakespeare may have seen that execution.
I mean, jumping ahead hundreds of years, you know, during the time of World War II, one of the more particularly vile parts of this play's history that certainly deserves scrutiny when we talk about it is that this play was a favorite of Nazi Germany. Between 33 and 39, there were more than 50 productions of it. It's not a terrifically far reach to exploit and to glorify these anti-Semitic elements of the play. You know, should we stop even producing this play? Do these few humanizing speeches fail to make up for the vicious overall portrait of Shylock? Should we stop bearing witness to these vile stereotypes year after year as this play gets produced? There are plenty of other offensive works of art, even though they, quote, accurately reflect the time in which they were written, that have effectively been shelved. Does The Merchant of Venice belong in this category?
It, like any good literature, it should be a vehicle for conversation for us today.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg presided over mock trials of The Merchant of Venice, where in Venice, where she went and she was a great admirer of Shakespeare, but she was not an apologist for The Merchant of Venice. One of the ones that she presided over at the end, she brought down the gavel and said that that the conversion that was sought by Antonio, she said, this is from a New York Times article, the defendant in the case was decreeing the sanction. I never heard of a defendant in any system turning into a judge as Antonio did. The unanimous ruling was to remove the question of the pound of flesh. They agreed that it was a merry sport that was quoted in the play and no court would enforce it. They decided to restore Shylock's property, to restore the 3,000 ducats that he had lent to Antonio, and to nullify the demand of his conversion. So she even contemporarily was a part of this conversation that continues to, you know, even to this day. So if those of you that are listening think you might want to engage and ponder these questions, you should come and read the play with us and make up your own mind on it. We'll be reading The Merchant of Venice on Sunday, April 11th on Zoom. You can find the link on the Pier 1 Theater website, as well as the Homer Library website and on Facebook through the college. And I just want to thank everybody for spending a half an hour with us today. And Mike, as always, thanks for your generosity with your time and your knowledge.
Happy to weigh in. These are fascinating topics.
Shakespeare in Context and the Second Sunday Shakespeare is brought to you by the Mud Bay Bards, the new creative branch of Pier 1 Theater focusing on the works of Shakespeare, the Friends of the Homer Library, and the Catchmac Bay Campus. Pier 1 Theater is made possible in part by grants from the City of Homer, the Alaska State Council on the Arts, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Rasmussen Foundation, the Homer Foundation, and by contributions from community members like you.